Howdy, y'all, and welcome. On this week's Tour of the Strange, we're going to kick off our first installment of the Monsters of the Midwest with the Show Me State's Own pumpkin-headed dog-munching cryptid, the unfortunately monikered Momo the Missouri Monster. Also, we'll learn about the bizarre final hours of one Thomas Meehan. All this and so much more awaits you. I'm Alan Brill, and this is Brilliant, a podcast from the mind of Brill. Warning, it gets dark in here. You know, folks, sometimes karma can be a real bear. On WTVR.com, and on December 9th, 2024, Lester C. Harvey Jr., 58, was part of a group of men going on a bear hunt in Lunenburg County, Virginia, who successfully cornered a large bear and chased it up a tree. The hunter then backed off, and one of them shot the animal, which fell and crashed down on Harvey, who was standing 10 feet away from the bottom of the tree, leaving him with severe injuries. His fellow hunters provided first aid until emergency services arrived, but despite the efforts of two different hospitals, Harvey died several days later. Now, any loss of human life is absolutely tragic, and my heart definitely goes out to the Harvey family. But I'm not going to lie, part of me is like, you know, good for you, Bear. On a hot summer afternoon in the small river town of Louisiana, Missouri, Terry Harrison, 8, and his younger brother Wally, 5, saw something terrible in their backyard, and the legend of Momo began. On July 12, 1972, Terry and Wally were playing in the backyard of the remote farmhouse at the end of Allen Street. The yard butted up against the heavily wooded Marzoff Hill, also known to the locals as Star Hill because of the giant star Christmas decoration they have. The two youngsters heard a low, throaty growl and looked up to witness a massive creature standing a mere 15 feet away. The creature was covered in long black hair that obscured its face, and it reeked of an unholy stench. The terrible thing had no neck and a pumpkin-shaped head. Ominously, it held what appeared to be a lifeless dog in one arm and had red splotches on its fur. The two brothers ran screaming into the house, where their 15-year-old sister Doris was cleaning the bathroom sink. Alarmed by the ruckus her brothers were raising, she looked up and through the bathroom window saw the beast that had elicited so much fear in her brothers. It was 6 or 7 feet tall, black and hairy, Doris told reporters. It stood like a man, but it didn't look like one. She told her brothers to stay inside and called her mother Betty, who immediately called her husband Edgar and told him to get home fast. She said something weird was going on and she's worried about the kids. He's home in less than half an hour. Edgar found no trace of the creature itself, but did find an area of flattened brush 50 feet from the house. Shortly after this incident, one of the Harrison's dogs became violently ill, vomiting for hours. At around 1:30 that night, Edgar heard sounds crashing from behind the house, what he described as the popping of brush, as if someone were running through the woods. He and four neighbors searched the immediate area, finding nothing. That's some pretty good neighbors to get out of bed at 1:30, 2 in the morning because you heard something running through the woods when, you know, you live in the woods where things run through. Anyway, the next night was much the same, only this time with 8 people in the search party, but with the same result. Buckle up, folks, because this is where things get weird. On July 14th, the Harrisons were hosting a weekly prayer meeting with about 30 attendees from the local Pentecostal church. Around 9 p.m., after most of the congregation had left, Edgar was standing outside with a dozen remaining guests when they saw several balls of light move from east to west just over the trees in the neighboring yard. They witnessed 2 more, one green, one white, go down in the vicinity of the nearby school. A short time later, after everyone had left, Harrison was unwinding in the yard playing his guitar when I heard something that sounded like a loud growl, he told reporters. It got louder and louder and kept coming closer. The rest of the family heard it as well and came barreling out of the house. They piled in the family car and pleaded with Edgar to jump in and drive them to safety, which, reluctantly, he did. Tearing down Marzoff Hill, they came upon, in Edgar's words, a mob of over 40 people coming towards my house. Some of them were carrying guns. They heard the same sounds we did. They had also seen the mysterious balls of light. Edgar stopped the car, but before he could communicate with the crowd, Betty screamed out of the car window, "Here it comes," and the mob quickly hightailed it back down the hill. After receiving reports of strange lights and disturbing sounds coming from Marzoff Hill, Police Chief Shelby Ward dispatched 2 officers to the scene. However, neither officer saw or heard anything. After the police left, Harrison and some neighbors searched Marzoff Hill more thoroughly. They didn't find the beast, but they did find an abandoned building whose interior reeked of, quote, a moldy horse smell or garbage smell. With a monstrous dog-killing beast on the loose and, even more worrisome, an armed mob chasing it, Edgar packed up his family and they crashed at the family restaurant they owned in town until the whole thing blew over. And that, my dear listener, was the saga of the Harrison family and the Beast of Marzoff Hill. Now, this is only the first chapter of a much longer and fascinating story. In the upcoming weeks, they'll have several more sightings, some more credible than others, and the Harrison's tale would spark a nationwide media frenzy. Hundreds of monster hunters would descend upon the small town of Louisiana and Marzoff Hill. They trespassed, trampled crops, tore down fences. Shots rang out on Marzoff Hill day and night. A bull was mistaken for the creature and shot dead. The owner was understandably furious, but there was no way of knowing which the monster hunters had killed it. The citizens of Louisiana were concerned that the next accidental killing might be a human. Chief Ward moved these invaders out of town as fast as he could, and they kept coming. He'd shovel them out, more would come in. And eventually he just had to declare Marzoff Hill off limits, and he blocked off Allen Street. But on the plus side, business was booming, cashing in on the wave of monster madness that crashed over the small community. You know, you could buy a Momo burger, get a Momo-sized deal at the local appliance store, and they were just making money off this thing left and right. And some intrepid reporter dubbed the monster Momo, short for Missouri Monster, and the name stuck. Largely, the phenomenon died down by mid-August as fairly short-lived, but it burned bright while it was here. And sightings are still reportedly throughout the years, and the last one being in 2007. Now, here's what I find interesting. The Harrison's encounter with Momo was not the first on record. A year earlier, in July of 1971, Joan Mills and Mary Ryan stopped at a scenic outturn in Pike County on their way home to St. Louis. They were at a concert in Chicago and driving back home to St. Louis, and they stopped off there to have a little break and eat some lunch. And they were preparing to eat their lunch of sandwiches when they were assaulted by a horrible stench, which Joan described as if coming from a family of skunks, but not a usual skunk smell. That means it stank, I'm guessing. Then they saw the thing emerge from the surrounding thicket. It was tall and primate-like and made strange gurgling sounds as it approached the women. Mary recalled, "It had hair all over its body, like an ape, yet the face was definitely human. It was more like a hairy human. The arms were partially covered with hair, but the hands and palms were hairless. We had plenty of time to see this." They jumped to their feet and fled to the car, abandoning their picnic. That's right. They left their sandwiches behind. They locked the doors, but when Joan went to start the car, she realized her keys were in her purse, on the picnic table. Next to the sandwiches, also on the picnic table. Never leave a good sandwich behind, folks. That's all I'm saying. The thing approached the car and put its hand on the hood and came around to the door. Joan said, "Finally, my arm hit the horn ring and the thing jumped straight up in the air and moved back. She continued to honk the horn, forcing it to retreat further. And at first it was scared, but eventually it figured out that the horn wasn't dangerous. The sound wasn't going to hurt it. So it moseyed on back to the picnic table and sniffed around their lunches. It picked up one of their sandwiches and devoured it in one bite. And then it picked up her purse, inspected it, dumped it out. Got bored and wandered back into the woods. Joan waited a few minutes and frantically retrieved her keys and they tore out of there. Now this is the part that's key for me. Upon returning home to St. Louis, they reported it to the Missouri State Highway Patrol. And since it was at that time an isolated incident and no crime was committed, save perhaps the burgling of a sandwich, they never really followed up, and you know, why would they? But a report was filed 1 year before the Harrison children's first encounter. A lot of times, you know, you'll have a report and this frenzy, and this was a big deal. Somebody will be like, "Oh, I saw it 7 months before, you know, anybody else did," but there's no proof of it. Here we have an actual report that this beast was sighted in the area a whole year before the frenzy kicked off. Now, let's talk about the pooch. Let's talk about the dog, Momo, with his lunch to go. Terry saw what he assumed was a dead dog being carried by Momo, but later he told his dad, Edgar, that all he knew was it had four legs and the same colored hair as the beast that carried it, and maybe had some red splotches on its fur. Now, here's a thought. Could it have been a baby Momo? Little baby Moo-Moo? I'm all about a little baby Moo-Moo. Somebody needs to make that plush toy right now. Oh, little baby Moo-Moo. Of course, every dog that went missing during this event was blamed on Moo-Moo, but is Moo-Moo a slayer of dogs or just a doting parent? And what about the mysterious lights in the sky? This is going to drive the flesh and blood Bigfoot crowd crazy, but there is a long history of UFO flaps and Bigfoot sightings. Are these two things related? I mean, not necessarily, but there's a long history there. And what the hell am I supposed to do with the info of the family dog getting violently ill that first night? I mean, that's just a coincidence, right? Or I don't know, maybe the dog got a mouthful of Momo and it didn't agree with it. I mean, I don't know what to make of it. I assume coincidence, but they reported it, so I'm telling you about it. And it's just one of those things that's going to get stuck in my head and drive me crazy. And, okay, there was the crazy loud growling that could apparently be heard all the way down the hill. And, I mean, enough to get 40 people to go charge it up the hill. I mean, that's not naturally loud. That's got to be supernaturally loud, right? And, I mean, you know, Bigfoot and the supernatural, they tend to go hand in hand. Does one attract the other, or is Bigfoot a supernatural creature? Is it completely unrelated? I don't know. We'll get into all that, but you know, not in episode one. And here's the thing: I'm guilty of this. It's like, what was Momo like? Oh, Missouri Bigfoot, you know, a skunk ape or whatever. But they'd seem to describe it more as a wild man, like a feral human, almost. Noticed that Mary said it looked more like a hairy human. That's her quote, and it doesn't have the typical Bigfoot features. The no neck, which is often reported, but Bigfoot usually has a conical shaped head, according to alleged sightings. This is a pumpkin head, and with the long hair that hangs down over its face. Could this just be something different, something unique? I don't know. It's just something to think about. And does Momo deserve the monster label? Really? I mean, what'd it do? I mean, okay, maybe killing a dog is a little bit monstrous, but Momo's got to eat, you know. And besides, we don't know the dog could have been little baby Momo. Other than that, you know, hung out in the woods, got chased by gun-toting mobs, and, you know, hung out, minded his own business. Maybe, you know, maybe a little growly. A little growly for a good neighbor, but otherwise, I don't know. I mean, Monster's definitely a better brand for it. Looks better on a t-shirt. But, you know, was Momo really a monster? I don't know. And perhaps the lingering, most important question that we have from the story is, what kind of sandwiches were they eating? I don't know. Read the books, read the articles, searched online, saw the movie. Nobody can really firmly say what kind of sandwich it was. Now, most people, they're leaning towards peanut butter sandwiches. Could have been bologna, though. We don't know. There's no record of it. But peanut butter's the best bet. Momo just in the woods at the picnic area, smashing out peanut butter sandwiches. I like it. Now, this was just a brief and woefully incomplete look at Missouri's favorite cryptid, mainly focusing on the Harrison family's experience. There's so much more of this story, though, and if you're interested, I couldn't more highly recommend Momo, The Strange Case of the Missouri Monster by Lyle Blackburn. Also, check out the movie, Momo, The Missouri Monster. It's a hybrid of the unreleased film from the 70s. They were trying to cash in on the Boggy Creek train of success. That movie was insanely popular, trying to catch in on that popularity, but the movie never made it past distribution. And it was never released. And the good folks at Small Town Monsters have released it. And in between, they've interspersed interviews and other documentary-type materials. So it's this hybrid movie. It's really cool. I would check it out. Okay, folks, it's that time of the show where if you have little ears listening, you might want to send them away for a second or two, or just skip forward about 2 minutes. This next part is for adults only. Oh yeah, pull the shades, light a candle, dim the lights, and snuggle up with the one you love, because it's time for Brilliant After Dark. All right, this week on Brilliant After Dark, we're heading down to the land of Carnival, Brazil. Of course, I got this from the mirror.co.uk, January 11th, 2025. A farm worker in Lajé da Ribeira, near the Brazilian capital of Brasilia, got up at 5 a.m. to milk the cows, but after taking some of the milk to his employer for his morning coffee, he failed to return home. Investigating, colleagues found the 45-year-old man in the cow shed, lying unconscious beside one of the cows. There was an open condom wrapper beside him, and when his friends turned him over, they found he was wearing the condom. Emergency services were called and tried to revive the unconscious man, but he went into cardiac arrest and died before he could be taken to the hospital. Police said they were working on the theory that the man had received a fatal kick to the head from the cow as he tried to have sex with it. Now, my first thought, why was he wearing a condom? Can you get an STD from a cow? A CTD? A BTD? Bovine transmitted disease? I needed answers. And fortunately, I live in the heart of farm country, so I took to Facebook for answers. I posted this, can you get an STD from a cow? Asking for a friend. The best answer I got was, no, just from monkeys. So, Uncle Google for the win. According to Google AI, humans cannot directly get an STD from a cow. However, some zoonotic diseases can be transmitted from cattle to humans through contaminated food or direct contact with the animals. So, there you go. That might be good information for some of y'all out there. You know, I don't know. No judgment. What follows is an account of the bizarre last day of Thomas Meehan. Thomas Meehan, age 38, was an attorney from Concord, California. On February 1, 1963, he was traveling from Eureka, California, bound for Concord at approximately 2 p.m. He made it as far as Myers Flat before stopping to telephone his wife, complaining that he felt ill. She told him to get a room and not try to drive through. From this point on, things get confusing. 5 p.m., Thomas Meehan checks into the 40 Winks Motel in Redway. 6 p.m., he drives to the Southern Humboldt Community Hospital. 6:45, Meehan tells the nurse that he felt as if he were dead. While checking him in and before seeing the doctor, Meehan disappears. 7 p.m., a Myers Flat couple reports to the highway patrol that they had seen the taillights of a car on Highway 101 driving to the Eel River. 8 p.m., Meehan was talking to Chip Nunnemaker, owner of the 40 Winks, and asked him, "Do I look like I'm dead? I feel like I've died and the whole world died with me." Nunnemaker noted that Meehan's shoes and trouser cuffs appeared wet and muddy. 9 p.m., Young, a motel employee, went to Meehan's room to inform him that the call he put through to Mrs. Meehan could not be completed due to a storm that had disrupted the telephone service. Young saw that Thomas had changed into a black suit with a white shirt. 10:45 p.m., the highway patrol found his car submerged in the Eel River, its taillights still shining like beacons for the searchers. Skid marks indicated that the vehicle had left the highway at a high rate of speed. They found blood on top of the car, and the right front window was open. Meehan was nowhere to be seen, but droplets of blood and muddy footprints led up the bank for 30 feet, then vanished. For the next 19 days, no trace of Meehan would be found. His body was eventually found in the Eel River, 16 miles downstream from where his car was discovered. The autopsy suggested the attorney survived the crash with a superficial head wound, then, later, died of drowning. Now, if it was Meehan's automobile that the couple seen going into the river at 7 p.m., and no other automobiles were reported missing or were ever found in the river on that date, then how could he be at the motel in time to chat with the owner from 8 to 9? Nunnemaker did note his muddy shoes and trouser cuffs and the strange claim that he felt dead. Also, his car was seen plunging into the river at the Eel River at about the same time he was sitting in a hospital room in Garberville. The nurse did not note any blood on his head, didn't say he was bleeding, didn't see on his clothes. Now, it said superficial head wound, so it could have healed and stopped bleeding by the, you know, we know that it gushed, as head wounds tend to do, because there's blood all over the riverbank and the car. So he would have got some on his clothes, and the nurse and probably the motel manager would have noticed that. So as it is, the timeline is super confusing and just doesn't make any sense. Unless, did Meehan actually drown when his car went into the river at 7 p.m.? Was the nurse and the motel owner all talking to a dead man? Now, that story was from Things That Go Bump in the Night by Brad Steiger. Great book. Check it out. Thank you for joining me on this week's stroll through the strange wilds of my mind, and I sure hope you'll join me again next time. Until then, I wish you well, but as you return to the normal world, be careful. It can get dark out there.